Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I am Raymond Stockstill of Paul Hastings and I represent petitioners. I would like to reserve 4 minutes of rebuttal time, please.
Okay, we'll try to remind you, but keep an eye on the clock.
Understood. Petitioners are a mother and her three sons who fled El Salvador for the United States. Each of them seeks asylum and withholding of removal based on a number of particular social groups, or PSGs, as well as relief under the Convention Against Torture, which I may refer to as CAT. Now, there are numerous independent bases for this court to rule in petitioner's favor, and they are detailed in petitioner's briefs. In my time today, I want to focus on 3 points in particular. The first is that petitioner's asylum and withholding of removal claims should be remanded because the board failed to conduct the requisite de novo review of the cognizability of certain PSGs. The second is that petitioner's asylum and withholding of removal claims should further be remanded because the immigration judge, or IJ, improperly and erroneously gave limited weight to the expert testimony of Dr. Thomas Borman based on a purported lack of citations or other corroboration. And the third is that petitioner's claims for relief under the Convention Against Torture should be remanded because the board failed to consider all relevant evidence. Now, as to the first point, with regard to the PSGs that the immigration judge found not cognizable, the board failed to conduct the requisite de novo review, and so remand is warranted. There is no dispute that the cognizability of an asserted PSG is a question of law review de novo, but the board failed to do that here. Its discussion affirming the IJ's determination of non-cognizability comprised just two textual sentences. That is insufficient. Indeed, the board's cursory discussion runs afoul of this court's recent decision in Diaz-Reynoso v. Barr, the citation for which is 968 F3rd 1070, and which was mentioned in petitioner's Rule 28J letter. In that opinion, this court emphasized that the board is required to conduct a thorough, case-specific inquiry when evaluating the cognizability of a PSG, and it remanded the case because the board failed to do that. The court should similarly remand here. As to the second point, remand is also warranted on the asylum and withholding of removal claims as to these PSGs because the immigration judge gave limited weight to Dr. Borman's testimony because of a purported lack of citations and other corroborating evidence. Now, as detailed in the briefs, petitioners dispute the premise that Dr. Borman's testimony lacked citation or other corroboration. But in any event, it was reversible error for the IJ to give limited weight to his testimony on this basis. And in addition to what petitioners already have in their briefs, petitioners emphasize that this court's recent decision from November in Castillo v. Barr, 980 F3rd 1278, is directly on point. That case, incidentally, involved the same expert, Dr. Borman. And there, the board, like the IJ here, gave reduced weight to Dr. Borman's testimony on the grounds of purported lack of corroboration by other evidence. This court, in a decision authored by Judge Wallace, correctly found that to be error warranting remand. So the court, citing Judge Posner's opinion in Velazquez-Venegas v. Lynch, explained that, quote, Dr. Borman's expert testimony was itself evidence that could support Castillo's claim. If an expert's opinion could only be relied upon if it were redundant with other evidence in the record, there would be no need for experts. The board therefore erred in giving Dr. Borman's testimony reduced weight, end quote. The court there remanded, and the same outcome is warranted here for the same reason. Now, respondents answering 28J letter attempts to distinguish that case from this one, but there really is no distinguishing them. They are squarely on point with each other. The IJ here, like the board in Castillo, gave Dr. Borman's testimony limited weight due to a purported lack of citation and corroboration. Under Castillo, that is clearly erroneous and warrants remand.
Okay, Your Honor, regardless of you know the weight given to the expert, looking at the particular social groups, and maybe starting with the women who are viewed as property by gang members, why doesn't that run afoul of the principle that you can't define the group solely in terms of the persecutor's perception? You have to show that there's social distinction within society at large.
Right, and I think this was detailed in the petitioner's brief before the BIA, but matter of AB wasn't argued before the Ninth Circuit here in the briefing. But I think the harm that What AB indicates is that the particular social group can't be defined exclusively by the harm. Here it's not. The harm is relevant in the sense that it's one of the catalysts for how the gang members may view, for why the gang members may view a particular victim as their property. But the definition of the group is the being viewed as property of the gang members, as opposed to the harm itself of having been victimized.
Right, but I mean, it sounds like right there in the definition of the group is, it's defined by how the gang members perceive the people in the group. You need to show that society in general perceives this to be a distinct group, don't you?
I believe so, and I believe, including with Dr. Borman's testimony, that is established, that status of the gang members viewing somebody as a victim is something that is perceived by society as a whole, in a way that you might recognize that somebody is, a widow. People in El Salvador can recognize victims of the gang members as being essentially controlled by and viewed as property of the gang members. With that, I will continue. So your honors may notice that I've been saying the IJ gave limited weight to Dr. Borman's testimony. I just note that because the board didn't address Dr. Borman's testimony at all as the PSG. So that goes back to the first point. And then lastly, petitioner's claims for relief under CAT should be remanded because the board failed to consider all relevant evidence. And I think this is briefed extensively in petitioner's briefs, including Colby Holder, this court's decision in 2011 that a board's decision cannot stand, or a board's decision denying CAT cannot stand where there's any indication the board didn't consider all the evidence. And here I think that's established. We would just emphasize that the Diaz-Reynoso case further reinforces this notion, as there the applicant similarly had testified that she reported her harm to authority figures and they did not help. Respondent's answering 28J letter attempts to draw distinctions between the facts of the what harm wasn't reported and who it was reported to. But the fact of the matter is the board should have considered this evidence and it didn't. So that requires remand.
Can you address the nexus claim for the oldest son, Brayan, on that one? I mean, wasn't it at least reasonable or plausible for the IJ to conclude that these gang members' acts were maybe motivated by a sense of, misguided machismo and not necessarily perceived sexual orientation of Rain? That is, these gang members thought, in their misguided way that these were insults directed at him for not joining a gang as opposed to perceiving that to be the eldest son's sexual orientation. I mean, why isn't that at least a reasonable interpretation of the evidence?
Well, I think because the petitioners don't have to establish that it was the sole reason or the primary reason, there's no obligation to rule out other potential motivations in a mixed motive type case. The question here is whether the evidence compels the conclusion that the gang members perceived Brian to be homosexual, and that was at least one central reason for asylum or a reason for withholding of removal. And I think the record, as detailed in our briefs, establishes that it was. Meanwhile, there is no evidence in the record suggesting that gang members in El Salvador utilize those sorts of homophobic slurs and molest their victims when they don't believe that the victim is homosexual. Whereas Dr. Borman testified that in his experience, those things indicate that they do. And he's not aware of use of those sorts of homophobic slurs like you might see in sort of...
Don't we even see that kind of behavior in here in this country in junior high school where, bullies use that kind of slurs, not because they perceive it as a victim's sexual orientation, because, again, through their misguided ways, they think it's an insult and they're just, being bullies. So isn't that a reasonable interpretation for the IJ to think that's what these gang members are doing?
Well, the interpretation of facts needs to be based on the gang members in El Salvador as opposed to what may be perceived in U.S. culture here on middle school playgrounds. And I think that's part of the IJ's error. There's an unfounded projection of that sort of perhaps U.S. cultural behavior onto the gang members, but there's no evidence in the record to support support that. And Dr. Borman says he's not aware of that in particular. So there's no evidence supporting it, and there is evidence contradicting it.
Thank you, counsel. We've used up all of your time, but we'll give you a minute for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll hear from the government now.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for your time this morning and the opportunity to discuss this case. My name is Mona Youssef. I represent the respondent. Now, I realize there's a lot of issues here, so I just wanted to ask first if there's any particular concerns the court might want to discuss first before I address petitioner's arguments.
Well, why don't you start with the issue we were just talking about the eldest son. We have not just the slurs about sexual orientation. We also have sort of sexualized physical mm-hmm. touching of him, accompanied by comments. I think they said, "Well, we know you'll like this mm-hmm. because of your sexual orientation." Well, why doesn't that compel the inference that his perceived sexual orientation was a significant part of the reason they did that?
Well, I think it's as the IJ explained, it's the way the whole circumstance happened. At first, if you look at his the declaration of the young boy that was harassed, he first stated that the group started to approach him when he was about 13, 14 years old, just as they did the other kids in the neighborhood, and they would threaten people saying, you know, if you don't join us, we're going to rape your mother, we're going to rape your sister. The young boy repeatedly refused to join the gang, and then it wasn't until he repeatedly refused to join that they started kind of using these degrading statements basically as a way to shame him or to humiliate him, say, oh, you act like a girl. Let me see, what else was there? You don't have the balls to join our gang. They were really just kind of mocking him. So I think substantial evidence in this case, based on the way the attack started and kind of progressed, supports the agency's decision that it was really their way of forcing him to join the group and shaming him when he refused to do so.
But why? I mean, that may have been part of their motive, but I don't see how that negates the proposition that his perceived sexual orientation was still a central reason for why they did it. I mean, there are lots of ways that you could insult someone, right? Mm-hmm. But they chose language and conduct directed at his perceived sexual orientation. And are we to infer that that was just a coincidence?
I think that was just a method. I think that was a means to an end is what the agency is saying here. I think when you look at motive, as you say, why is somebody picking on somebody? And here it seems pretty clear that they're picking on him because they want him to join the gang. That's their ultimate purpose. They need more members. He's a young boy. He fits the demographic. He's in the neighborhood. He's 14, 15 years old. That's who they recruit to do some of their crimes. Would they have picked on him if they didn't want him to be in the group? That's left unclear based on this evidence. So I think the board or the agency was basically saying that there's not enough evidence here to include that as a motive for picking on him.
What would, give me an example of this sort of, assuming that, we have the evidence that they're interested in him joining the gang, what more would they have to do in order for it to be clear that his perceived sexual orientation was a central reason for the conduct?
I mean, I think it would have been just based on the totality of the circumstances. They had come up to him and been like, hey, called him names, called him a girl. Hey, you don't have enough balls to join us. Prove to us that you're not gay or something like that. If they had started out their pursuit of him in that way, that would have lended support that was one of their motivating factors. Maybe if there had also been evidence provided that, hey, they target homosexual boys to join their gang. I don't remember that being part of the record. There's a lot of information in this record saying that homosexuals and anybody in the LGBT community faces harm and discrimination. But I didn't see anything that said that homosexual boys are targeted for gang membership.
Can I ask a question about the mother?
Yes.
So the IJ found that she hadn't proven that she would be tortured if she removed, if she was returned home. Mm-hmm. I mean, the fact that she was gang raped, mm-hmm. that she reported it and was hung up on, is it your position that's not torture and that she couldn't expect that same treatment if she was returned? I'm having trouble with this.
The only time that she called police is during the extortion claim that happened before the gang rape. So our point for that was that evidence, petitioner makes a claim that that should have been considered when considering CAT. But in that case, all that was said in the record, let me just...
And check me on this, counsel, while you're looking for that.
Yes.
The BIA didn't address it, right? At all?
Well, what happened was, I believe the petitioner addressed it in his brief before the board. I think it was like pages 58 and 59. And then if you read the court's decision, they say, we're not going to touch the whether or not you are tortured or not. They kind of didn't address whether these particular individuals had been tortured in the past. They base their claim on there's no evidence that the government would acquiesce to their torture in the future, or at least that more likely than not, the government would acquiesce in the future.
On that point, the BIA didn't address the mother's testimony that she called the police and the police hung up on her, right? I mean, the BIA should have at least addressed that point, because it does go into issue of whether its government is acquiescing to the gang members' actions.
If that was the standard, whether or not they had to consider acquiescence to gang actions. But here, again, she reported, I'm sorry, there's just so many notes in here. She basically called, and she's in her declaration, she said that she called the police and told them that she was being extorted and that they said they couldn't help her. Now, you're in a country where many, many people are extorted. If she had called and she had said somebody attempted to rape me or somebody did rape me and they hung up on her, or they said, we can't help you, that definitely would have been relevant information that the board should have addressed when adjudicating CAT. But here it's unclear whether or not if somebody refuses to help an extortion victim that's been extorted over the phone is the same as claiming that because they didn't help me when I was extorted, they're not going to help me when I'm actually tortured. And extortion really isn't, it's not torture, but I don't have any case law to support that right now.
Isn't it? I mean, if the BIA said what you're saying now, maybe, you know, they addressed it, but it seems like they just didn't consider it at all. We don't know what the, you know, we need BIA to first address it. So shouldn't we remand that issue?
If you think that not helping an extortion victim is the same as saying that the police are not going to acquiesce to somebody who's going to be tortured, I would argue that's not the same. I can say, and I know this court sees countless immigration cases, this particular board decision and the IJ decision is incredibly detailed for an agency decision. I mean, they talked about everything in this case. They listed all the facts. They explained why they didn't weigh certain statements by Dr. Borman as heavily as other statements made by him. So I would say that this case does not, it seems that the board actually did consider all the evidence in this case, and that would not be a reason for remand. Are there any other questions?
Looks like there are not, so.
Well, would you like me to address the whole the Dr. Borman, or do you have no concerns at that time?
You have a minute left, so.
Okay. All right. I would just like to point out that the three cases that basically address the expert testimony are Cole, Castillo, and there's also the Seventh Circuit case that's being referenced, Velasquez Benengas. And in all those cases, there actually were corroborating country reports that corroborated the expert's testimony in those cases. That's really not the case here. I think what happened here is you have Professor Borman, who's qualified as an expert for many different countries, and you can't be an expert in all things. And what the immigration judge was basically saying is that she wanted to make sure that any statement he made was based on objective factual predicate. And the lack of corroborating evidence and citation made it unclear whether or not particular opinions were based on an objective factual predicate. And since I'm out of time, I'd like to thank you for your time and thank you for listening today.
Thank you, counsel. And one minute for rebuttal.
Thank you. I'll briefly mention that not helping an extortion victim, there was that whole discussion. That wasn't the only thing the BIA didn't consider. And so I would encourage the panel to look back at the briefs, which explain the insufficiency of the BIA's decision. It may have been 7 pages long, but it was primarily discussing setting up the legal standards and not actually discussing the facts, which it mischaracterized as only indicating high crime rates and general corruption. With regard to Brian and the nexus, in terms of recruitment, this is addressed on page 7 of the reply. Dr. Borman testified he was being recruited for servitude, not actual membership. And as the panel picked up on, there's a statement here by the persecutors while molesting him where they said, we are doing this because we know you like it, because we know you like to be, we know you like men and to be touched like a woman. Under Lee v. Holder, that is direct evidence of their motive and their belief. And so I think the case law is clear that remand is warranted here because the evidence compels the conclusion that the nexus is established. With that, I know that I'm out of time, and so I thank you for your time.
Thank you, counsel. We thank both counsel for their very helpful arguments this morning. The case just argued is submitted, and with that, we are adjourned for the day.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This court for this session stands adjourned.